Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
What's in a name? Well, in some cases, maybe your entire future. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl, who is unfortunately still under the weather. It's Wednesday, September 2nd, and thank you for joining us. We've been covering Europe's struggles with, well, let's say people leaving their homes for European countries. Hundreds of thousands of them are flowing into the continent after long and possibly dangerous journeys over land and sea. Many are fleeing Syria or other armed conflicts. As European nations struggle with how to deal with these travelers, you'll often hear them called migrants, and you'll just as often hear them called refugees. And Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson is here to explain the difference between those two designations. Hi, Tracy.
Hey, Molly.
So we hear these words, migrant and refugee, used basically interchangeably, but they're actually very different, right?
They are very different. Refugees are typically people who have had to leave their home country due to a fear of persecution because of maybe who they are, their race, their religion, maybe their politics. They're often in danger. I gave a call to Jim Hathaway. He's the director of the University of Michigan's program in refugee and asylum law, and here is how he breaks it down.
In simplistic terms, the difference is between push and pull. Life is never quite that simple, but a migrant is someone who chooses to move rather than is literally forced to move.
So the migrant maybe wants the chance of a better job, of better schools for their kids, maybe to reunite with their family. But as Hathaway mentioned, in practice, distinguishing between migrants and refugees can be complicated.
Right. And who are the people then who are showing up in Europe? What is the breakdown there?
It's a mix of both refugees and migrants. Two-thirds of these new arrivals are from Syria, Afghanistan, Somalia, and Eritrea, all of which are referred to as refugee-producing states, either because of ongoing wars or long records of human rights abuses. I also talked to Bill Frelick with the Human Rights Watch. He says some migrants are crossing into Europe for economic reasons.
There certainly will be and are people that are in the mix who are economic migrants who maybe are fleeing some very compelling situations of poverty, but who do not have a claim for international protection under the Refugee Convention and the other instruments, as they're called, for protecting people and not sending them back to their home countries.
So fleeing climate change, fleeing famine, fleeing horrible poverty, that may not feel like a choice to the person who's doing it. But Frelick says that doesn't qualify someone under the refugee standard that some 150 countries agreed to after World War II.
So then what happens to those people who are fleeing horrible poverty? How does the label change the way someone is treated?
It can be a world of difference for someone's future, for their health and safety, for their economic outlook. It basically can mean the difference between staying and going, between getting the protection of the international community or not. Migrants aren't guaranteed a right of entry into a country at all. But when someone arrives, say, in the EU and claims to be a refugee, there is a specific process that then kicks in. Countries review their claims, and in the meantime, that person, they can't be detained. They have to be treated humanely. This process is supposed to be uniform across all EU countries. In practice, we're seeing it applied very differently depending on the country someone arrives in. Some countries like Germany have been much more willing to accept refugees and to give them all of the protections that comes with that status, others less so. And Molly, this is where you might get the confusion between the use of refugee and migrant. Some people, some politicians will use those terms interchangeably because they simply don't know the difference or they don't care to distinguish between them. Others use the term migrant to refer to a refugee because they don't want to accept responsibility for them, to take them in.
Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Molly.
On Wall Street today, finally, a little bit of green. We'll have more when we do the numbers.
Marketplace.
As anyone who follows politics knows, you live and die by the polls. So when CNN started putting together its Republican presidential debate, it figured it would have at least 15 national polls to help it decide who to put on stage. Turns out, it only ended up with 5. The result is that CNN is tweaking its own rules to figure out the top candidates. That will probably have the crowd-pleasing result of putting Carly Fiorina on stage in primetime. But it also points out some interesting things about the business of polling. As Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports, polling is an increasingly inexact science.
Pollsters' track records took a hit over the past few years. Gallup predicted that Mitt Romney would win the popular vote by a percentage point in 2012. In the 2014 midterm elections, some pollsters were surprised by the Republican takeover of Congress. Robert Y. Shapiro teaches political science at Columbia University.
Young adults, minorities, and others stayed home. In contrast, whites and older voters voted more than Democrats.
Turns out young adults and minorities are the hardest voters for pollsters to reach, according to Frank Newport, editor-in-chief of Gallup. Millennials may only have a cell phone, and Newport says there can be language barriers with minorities. Plus,
these people also may be less willing to be interviewed in general. Some don't have phones or may be less likely to be contacted.
Cliff Zukin teaches public policy and political science at Rutgers. He calls the pollsters' misfires spectacular disasters and says they're caused by two trends. First, a plummeting response rate. And second, the proliferation of cell phones. Pollsters aren't allowed to mass dial them with computers. Actual humans have to make every call. Zukin says that's expensive.
It's much more expensive, maybe 3 times more expensive than it was 4 years ago to do this stuff right now.
Zukin says that's led pollsters to cut corners. Some are doing online polling instead.
These are guys who are trying new things, and they haven't had good results, but they're making a lot of money because it costs so little to do an internet poll.
But you get what you pay for. Zukin has some advice for voters in the 2016 presidential election. Take the polls with a huge grain of salt, because polling has become more art than science. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Whatever CNN is planning to do with the debate, it looks like it's going to pay off. Ad Age reports today that the network is asking 40 times its normal rate for commercial space during the presentation, up to $200,000 for a 30-second spot. The typical primetime spot costs more like $5,000 most of the time. Everybody loves a parade, right? When things are down, there's nothing like a demonstration of your military might and your victorious war history to cheer people right up. At least, that's what China's leaders are hoping. They're holding a huge military parade on Thursday, partly to celebrate China's resistance against the Japanese during World War II, partly to distract its citizens from a pretty tough month. A massive chemical explosion that wiped out part of a city, the country's first currency devaluation in 20 years, and a stock market crash that's had the world's economy in chaos. So can a really big propaganda parade turn those frowns upside down? Marketplace China correspondent Rob Schmitz reports.
The last time China held a military parade was 6 years ago. That was for the People's Republic of China's 60th birthday. The official government reason for Thursday's parade? Commemoration of 70th anniversary of victory of Chinese people's resistance against Japanese aggression and world anti-fascist war. How about this? 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. According to Dali Yang, director of the University of Chicago's Center in Beijing, China's leaders are putting on this parade to send two important messages. He says the first one is for the rest of the world.
The Chinese leadership is trying to send a signal to the West in particular that China was then allied with the West. At the time, communist countries and capitalist countries were allied against fascists.
But here's the problem. The leaders of China's old wartime allies like the U.S. and the U.K. aren't attending the celebration against fascism. So who RSVP'd? The list includes Russian strongman Vladimir Putin, Venezuela's dictator Nicolas Maduro, and Sudan's Omar Hassan al-Bashir. That last one, by the way, is wanted by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity and genocide. They'll all sit together while Chinese troops goose-step by, a type of marching George Orwell called one of the most horrible sights in the world. Which leads us to what Professor Yang says is the second more important message China wants to convey with this parade.
Having such a parade would allow President Xi, who has been fighting against corruption, trying to consolidate his power within the military, to show to the country that he is the person in command of the military and China stands strong and tall in the world.
At no other time in Xi Jinping's presidency has it been so crucial to convince his countrymen he's in control. The 62-year-old leader has sent shockwaves through China's Communist Party after his anti-corruption campaign led to disciplinary actions against 414,000 government officials. China's economic transition has also been a little bumpy. But whenever the going gets tough in China, a familiar enemy is rolled out. Historian Jeremiah Jenny says the parade is about more than just an anniversary.
One thing the country can get behind is a general and well-entrenched loathing of Japan.
The Japanese killed an estimated 20 million Chinese in World War II. Only the Soviet Union lost more people in the conflict. China's key role in fighting off the Japanese is largely forgotten in the West. But it's not in China. Since the 1980s, state broadcasters have aired 302 television series chronicling China's wartime resistance to the Japanese. These anti-Japanese war dramas, including a cartoon for children, are played on Chinese television constantly. The residue of all this programming rushes to the surface when I ask residents in an alley neighborhood behind Beijing's Tiananmen Square whether they're going to watch Thursday's parade.
You bet I'm going to go and watch. Down with Japanese imperialism. Down with Japan.
Shop owner Zeng Xiangren's three-year-old companion yells down with Japan, too. Across town on the campus of People's University, the opinion about Japan is more nuanced. 19-year-old incoming freshman Hu Jingyi.
I feel like as individuals, the Japanese are good. Their education level is high. But as a nation, their ideas are extreme. I just feel like they're very frightening. Their national cohesion is very scary.
National cohesion can be very scary. But for a fast-rising global power dealing with the demons of its past while trying to manage an historic economic transformation in the present, national cohesion can also be seen as crucial. In Beijing, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Coming up.
You know, I think a lot of people were buying those not as an investment, but as really a contribution to the war.
War bonds might have been all the rage 70 years ago, but today, not so much. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average jumped 293 points, or 1.8%, to close at 16,351. Finally, some good news. The NASDAQ gained 113 points, 2.4% to finish at 4749. And the S&P 500 added 35 points, 1.8% to end at 1948. Signs of health for the financial sector, too. The Feds reported today that U.S. bank earnings rose 7% in the first quarter of this year. Bank of America increased 2%, Citigroup up more than 1.5%, J.P. Morgan Chase deposited 1.8%, Wells Fargo up 2%, and Goldman Sachs up 1.3%. Falling oil prices also lifted airlines today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.18%, and you're listening to Marketplace. You're listening to Marketplace. I am Molly Wood. It's almost time for the official start of the NFL season, and the league is in the news, kind of like it always is, if you think about it. For example, there's a New York Times report today about the upcoming movie Concussion. It deals with brain damage caused by NFL players' repeated head injuries, and whether Sony Pictures softened the script to avoid offending the NFL. The movie's director says that didn't happen, but leaked emails from the Sony hack suggest otherwise. Either way, the story helps cement the impression that the NFL is so powerful that it gets whatever it wants. And a big part of that power comes from the fact that the NFL has turned itself into a year-round media force. Marketplace's Gigi Duban has more.
17 weeks. That's how long NFL season lasts, technically. But there's also free agency, scouting combine, the draft, training camp. And let's not forget fantasy football. People have to check on who's injured and who's looking good, right?
I think they've really achieved a nice balance of being able to have events that people continuously look forward to during the offseason.
Rodney Paul teaches sport management at Syracuse University. He says spacing out events throughout the year keeps people buzzing about the sport. And it fills those quieter off months, says Peter Rosenberger. He teaches sport management at NYU.
So that it becomes nearly a full 12-month cycle where there's constant interest and chatter.
And that chatter is all over sites like Facebook and Twitter, even when you think it's time to move on, Rosenberger says.
Start watching hockey, folks. Hockey's a great sport. No. We're going to designate JP, our franchise player for the New York Giants. Well, that's all great until he blows his finger off on the 4th of July.
Rosenberger says social media has been the jet fuel of fans' year-round demand for all things NFL. And even when there's bad news, there's just more to talk about, says Mike Lewis. He teaches marketing at Emory University.
To some extent, the bad news is part of their success. Because, you know, when something goes wrong, if it's associated with the NFL, this becomes a major media story.
For example, the NFL's concussion crisis. The league is paying hundreds of millions of dollars to settle lawsuits by 5,000 former players who say the league covered up the danger from concussions. That hasn't put a dent in the sport. Yet. I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Let's take another look at the European migrant crisis and where some of these travelers are ending up as they enter the continent and try to claim asylum. The BBC's James Reynolds has followed one Syrian refugee, 20-year-old Noor Amar, as she makes her way through Europe to Sweden.
I don't want to be Syrian anymore, you know. Everything hurts for Syrian people. So that's why I need to go. I'm supposed to go. I don't have another choice.
20-year-old Noor Amar lost her father and her home in the Syrian war. She's now left her mother in exile in Turkey to escape to Sweden. For 2,000 miles through 9 countries by boat, bus and train, she has to avoid being caught by the police. Noor's trail heads north through the crush of refugees at a bus station on the Greece-Macedonia border. She and her friends have made it on a smuggler's boat from Turkey to Greece. Now they've got to continue overland. After a week of travel, Noor is exhausted.
Actually, we sleep out the streets, you know?
You slept on the street?
Yeah, we sleep in the streets like 3 or 4 days. We want to have a bathroom. It's very bad, actually.
Noor's group takes the bus into Serbia, the fourth country on her trail.
We are very tired, very sick, all of us, because it was yesterday very cold.
They don't want to get stopped. Noor is desperate not to be found and fingerprinted on her way to Sweden. In theory, you have to stop and apply for asylum in the country which first registers you. In Serbia's capital, Noor and her friends have found a secret place to stay. At dusk the next day, hundreds of migrants and refugees walk across the border into Hungary, where they'll be met by the Hungarian police. But Noor and her group don't want to be spotted. Late at night, they pay a driver to drop them 10 miles from the Hungary border.
What are you all going to do now?
Actually, I'm very afraid because we will bus Hungary.
So you'll cross the Hungary border?
Yeah, the most important place, actually.
This is the most important crossing?
Yeah, if we're busing safe, we are safe, yeah.
The group walks for hours through the night along a deserted track. They finally make it into Hungary and what should be the safety of the EU's border-free zone. But getting to Budapest brings a new scare. The police come to the apartment in which they're staying and demand a €50 bribe not to take them in. Days later, from Vienna, Noor takes the train towards her final stop, Gothenburg, in Sweden. Her friends have gone separately to Germany. She can only relax once she's crossed her final border. In Sweden, Noor is finally able to declare herself to the authorities. She leaves the train station and turns left.
Noor, where are you going?
I'm going to British station.
What are you going to tell them?
I'll tell them I'm from Syria. I want to have asylum here. I would like to have asylum.
Noor Amar's journey from exile in Turkey all the way to the front door of a Gothenburg police station has taken 2 weeks and 13 hours. It's cost her 3,000 euros, and it's bought her a new life.
That's the BBC's James Reynolds. As you heard earlier in the show, this is the year that the world has been commemorating the 70th anniversary of World War II. May 8th marked the anniversary of victory in Europe, and today, September 2nd, marks the formal surrender of Japan, which ended the war in the Pacific. World War II was also the last time the U.S. used something called the war bond. These were saving bonds marketed as a way to help pay for the war effort. And they symbolized a kind of national unity that, as Marketplace's Sabri Benashour reports, the U.S. might not see again anytime soon.
Oklahoma City, 1941. Kenneth McGee was 13 years old, and his dad went off to war.
Those were scary days. Those were very, very scary days.
McGee was not content to sit around collecting tinfoil like the other kids, as he puts it.
So I went in and volunteered in a war bond effort, and I actually went door to door selling war bonds.
He was the youngest war bond salesman in Oklahoma, according to papers at the time.
You know, I think a lot of people were buying those not as an investment, but as really a contribution to the war.
All in all, the U.S. raised more than $150 billion from those bonds. Many were never cashed in, and nobody knows how many are still out there. The Treasury claims it's less than $500,000 worth. Others claim the number is in the billions. Some of them are here in New York at the American Museum of Finance.
Look at the color on these, though. See? I would say candy apple red.
Lawrence Schuffman is a financial historian. He's looking at an exhibit on the wall. Schuffman also collects war bonds. He's really crazy about them.
It would be nice today to have celebrities and movie stars getting behind the government, if not for a war effort, to maybe finding some way to save America, save our infrastructure, help our veterans, do something.
There are a couple reasons that might be a tall order today. An infrastructure bond sounds nice, but the money might not actually go to infrastructure. The last time Congress allowed a bond to be actually tied to a specific purpose was in 1911 for the Panama Canal. Even the war bonds went into a general fund. Another issue, at least for a mega bond campaign.
Yes, they used it to raise money for the war, but the major impetus for the war bonds program was anti-inflationary.
James Kimball teaches at Seton Hall University. Inflation was a big risk at the time, and Kimball says the government wanted to reduce people's consumption to fight that inflation. Contrast that to the period after September 11th, when the country's leaders urged Americans to consume more to support the country. In New York, I'm Sabri Benashour for Marketplace.
This final note before we go, the online streaming TV service Hulu has a new offering out today for all of you who are thinking about cutting the cord. For $12 a month, you can subscribe to Hulu's commercial-free option. Hulu has a big collection of TV shows from major networks like Empire, Modern Family, and now lots of new movies from Epix. People generally love it, especially if they don't have cable, but they hate the ads, which are often repetitive and somehow even more annoying than TV. Customers have been begging for an option to pay more to skip commercials. Well, it looks like that day has finally come with what Hulu calls the no commercials plan. But there's a catch. Hulu says some of its agreements with broadcasters means it can't actually get rid of commercials completely. The ads won't show up during the show, but if you're a fan of Grey's Anatomy, Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., or Scandal, you'll still see an ad before the show plays and one after. So really, it's not exactly no commercials. It's more like mostly no commercials. Hey, but it's a start. All right, that's the end of the show. Today, the Dow jumped 293 points, 1.8%. The NASDAQ gained 113 points, 2.4%. And the S&P 500 added 35 points, 1.8%. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Michael Raphael, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the program for us. I am Molly Wood, and we'll be back again tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.